It's time once again for Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 5 years has shared with us her extensive research into political assassinations and abuses of power in this country. Her program relates the news of the week to emerging evidence about the conspiracy which allegedly maintains by force its control over the legislative, executive, and judicial processes in America. And now, Mae Brussel.
Good afternoon. This is Mae Brussel, and it's KLRB, Carmel, California. This is March 14th, 1977, and it's Dialogue Conspiracy number 260. One local announcement that I want to make that doesn't pertain to people in the East or North, but for people in Carmel, California. The play Kennedy's Children is here at Carmel Monterey Peninsula College this next weekend, Saturday night. And it's an excellent play. I'm going to see it Friday night. I saw it in New York, and I saw it again in San Francisco. And I think it's a play that people should see who are concerned with the era, with the 60s and 70s. And it's really a dynamite show. So for people in the local area that are listening or up from Santa Cruz that want to come down, Kennedy's Children is at Monterey Peninsula College this weekend. Every once in a while in Dialogue Conspiracy, in between the rattling on of various murders and conspiracies that I talk about, I do like to pause and give a brief resume for new listeners, a little bit about the show. We do this about twice a year, three times a year, because there are many new people that I speak to that begin listening at a certain point and do not get the overall pattern of what I am leading up to. So those of you who have been listening for many years, who tape it regularly, you can bear with me, and I do feel that I should repeat once in a while what this show is about, because I believe it is the most unusual newscast, if you call it a newscast, on the air in the country. The show began in the spring of 1971, after Daniel Ellsberg released the controversial Pentagon Papers. And at that time, I came to the news department at KLRB to do just one show talking about the meaning of the papers. And I said that the release of the information about the Vietnamese War was a big story, but even though it got a lot of attention, the biggest story in the country was the killing of President John Kennedy and Malcolm X and Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King, Reverend Martin Luther King, because they were murdered by our own intelligence community, the help of the CIA, the FBI, the Pentagon, the police departments, and then were covered up by the highest levels of government. And I consider that the number one story, and I'm still waiting for these facts to break out in the open. And it was because of my research into these assassinations that I was able in 1972, August 72, to publish in The Realist the story of Watergate, to break the first story of who was behind Watergate and link it all the way back, certain people, to the Kennedy assassination. McCall Magazine this month has an article by Vivian Cadden. It's March 1977, and it's titled The Murder of President Kennedy. And in it, this is what Ms. Cadden says. She says, a new picture of the assassination of John F. Kennedy is beginning to emerge, one that may shock us even more with revelations about morality and methods of our government than Watergate did. Now, that is true. Watergate is a small story, and if Watergate removed the President of the United States and the Vice President and the Attorney General and the Secretary of Commerce and two of the highest officials of the CIA, three of them really, Richard Helms, James McCourtney, Howard Hunt, and touched literally hundreds of lives, I'm waiting for the big story to break. And of course, I know the committee in Washington will not be able ever to open up the Kennedy story the way it should be done, but it will break because there's just too much evidence to continue suppressing through the years. What I've tried to explain to listeners on Dialogue Conspiracy is, in general, the assassination syndrome. We go at great length, sometimes into evidence that's covering up the John Kennedy assassination and Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy, or the Chappaquiddick affair, or the shooting of George Wallace, or the Sharon Tate massacre down Los Angeles, which I put in the ilk of a political massacre and not a simple hippie commune type of thing at all. I think there were political connotations to that, and it was very important that it took place at the time it did, the murders down there in Los Angeles, in Sharon Tate's home, at the home of Mr. and Mrs. LaBianca. But in the course of studying the government's cover-ups and State Department papers or papers from Navy intelligence or the Defense Intelligence Agencies, I've included in my research something even grander, and it began to go into murders of judges and lawyers and actors, musicians, witnesses to trials, selected prisoners, writers, civil rights leaders, Indian leaders, Chicano leaders, congressmen, politicians, members of the Muslim organization, and even leaders of organized crime that were used by the intelligence community and then murdered, and of course, labor leaders that have been murdered. The person who I've quoted many times, who I consider an expert on political assassinations, is a man named Emil J. Gumbel, G-U-M-B-E-L, and he lived in Heidelberg, Germany. He taught the university there in, I think it was science, work, or mathematics, and he was fired in September of 1932 at Heidelberg, and his crime, according to the people at the university for firing him, was that he was an outspoken critic of war. He once in his class made the statement, "A turnip is better than a war memorial." And after that, he was called to the office, and he was fired, and that was 1 year before Adolf Hitler came to power. Gumbel had a statement, public statement at the time that was printed in Time magazine in 1932, September 32. He said, "One doesn't become popular by saying that a popular policy will lead a country to catastrophe, especially if events have shown it to be true. There is no question that I am a pacifist. I am an anti-fascist." And while in Germany between 1919 and 1922, Gumbel put together three books. One was called 4 Years of War Lies, the other was 2 Years of Political Murders, and one was called 4 Years of Political Murders. And in these books, he listed proof of over 400 political assassinations. And the Minister of Justice in Germany, even preceding Adolf Hitler, did not deny that these assassinations were taking place. He admitted them, the truth, but they didn't do anything about them. They admitted the truth of the murders, but let them slide by. Well, Gumbel later left Germany and came to the United States. He taught at Columbia University, and he went back to Germany after the war. But the part that interested me about E.J. Gumbel's book, Inspection for Disarmament, has a chapter of it. It's a book that came out recently. And in that book, they have some quotations of Gumbel. But two factors took place in Germany which parallel what is happening in the United States today. And one factor was doing the murders that were necessary to change the entire climate so that fascism would be acceptable. That is, killing labor leaders, newspaper people, critics of Adolf Hitler and the rearmament of Germany, anti-war people, various leaders. It became necessary to kill a minimum of 400. But until Hitler was elected in 1933, there was another trick. And because otherwise it would look like fascism, and this was a democracy that was being elected. They had an election. And the big problem was to conceal who was doing the murders, 400 minimum. And E.J. Gumbel wrote at the time that the role of the courts was the important tricky thing, because the murders were one thing, to accomplish them was not difficult, but to blame somebody else for them, it was a double barrel thing. The people that were killing the selected targets, such as certain persons that are killed in this country, we have to guarantee that they're real assassins, get off or paid off, or the courts get them off if they have to be arrested, such as in the Watergate case or many cases I can cite, too many unfortunately. But the trick is sometimes to lock up guilty people and blame it on them, because then you accomplish two things at one time. You create a given enemy by pointing at certain people, and you lock up your patsies. In the meanwhile, the courts let the other ones go free. So Gumbel said the political assassinations put a heavy burden on the administration of justice. I put justice in quotes. The murderers had to be acquitted, and the victims had to be shown as guilty. The task was fulfilled by the employment of military courts, which sided with the military men when they were accused of murder, by the slowness of justice, of the enforcing agencies, by the inability to find the guilty, by issuing false papers of identity, by the police cooperating, by accepting at face value the claim of the accused murderer that the victim had tried to escape, and therefore you had to shoot him at the time. To ensure their sentences, the Reichswehr was responsible for the secret rearmament of Germany, and they used certain witnesses for the prosecution that worked with the police department, and these witnesses were important to the case. So the role of the courts, and this is the thing that matters to me in this country, in addition to the assassinations, is the gross ignoring of evidence in our courts, which is getting so flagrant that the courts aren't even functioning in this country in any sense of the word. The same way was happening in Nazi Germany. And the murders were acquitted. It's worse than that. In this country, the murders of John Kennedy are free, and even gunmen that were involved in the crossfire are not called to testify before Congress, are not called to the Justice Department. The gentleman who is allegedly fired the gun behind Robert Kennedy, Thane Caesar, passes around Los Angeles. He's known to the police department. He was the star of the movie The Second Gun. He's from Lockheed. He pulled a gun the night Robert Kennedy was killed. The autopsy report locates the fatal bullets to be just where he was when his gun was pulled. The physical evidence was thrown away. Thane Caesar's out on the streets, and the law enforcement even know where he is, and he's not arrested. In the meanwhile, certain patsies are locked up. Or you have Sirhan and James Earl Ray. The R.B. Oswald said he was a patsy, and he was shot within 2 days. The victims in Germany had to be shown as guilty, and we have that in this country. Sarah Moore is locked up, even though we know that she didn't arrange that whole shooting of Gerald Ford, and any more than Squeaky Fromm could get close to the President of the United States unless the security and the police wanted her to be in that position. Almost shaking his hand, Gerald Ford was on the Monterey Peninsula a few times. You couldn't get near a freeway entrance, and everything is blocked off around him. And then there's certain victims that are locked up. Rochelle McGee is one of them that's blamed with a shootout up at when Judge Haley was killed up at San Quentin. He's in San Quentin now, or Folsom, but Rochelle McGee was charged with a shootout at the Marine Center, the county courthouse there. And there's people like Hugo Pinnell charged with the murder of a guard, or at the shootout at the time George Jackson was killed, who are innocent, who are charged with being guilty. As I say, in Nazi Germany, the courts were used to either acquit people or let murderers off or look the other way. In this country, I'm not only talking about murders, but I'm talking about conspiracies. People by Richard Nixon get pardoned. Henry Kissinger is named by Richard Helms as being the person who ordered him to perjure himself. He had people wiretapped in this country, which is illegal and bugged, and was involved in Watergate crimes. Kissinger gets a reward of $2 million and his staff at NBC and memoirs, and Richard Nixon is selling his memoirs. Gerald Ford and Betty Ford are each getting $1 million each for their memoirs. When Gerald Ford should go to court for perjury at his hearings, he said that he did not take secret documents when he wrote his book, The Portrait of the Assassin, on Oswald, yet he took top secret documents identical to what Daniel Ellsberg did and commercialized and wrote a book. He covered up the crime of murder for the President of the United States. He was never charged with that crime, and he should have been charged at his hearings. He said he would never, the people would never stand for pardoning Richard Nixon, then he immediately pardoned Richard Nixon. Richard Helms was brought home from Iran as the ambassador to Iran, and they considered, the Justice Department considered charging him with perjury, but Jimmy Carter's Justice Department isn't any different, not one bit different, than the Justice Department of Richard Nixon or Lyndon Johnson or Jerry Ford, and they will not charge Richard Helms with any perjury on the ITT matter in Chile, or Mr. Janine of ITT. They all perjured themselves before Senate hearings and took an oath. But Richard Helms says, if you charge me, I'll implicate Henry Kissinger and others. And Kissinger is some holy cow who can't be implicated. So Richard Helms isn't charged. And Maurice Stans and John Mitchell got off of a hearing in New York City, a trial on Robert Vesco giving $200,000 to agents of Robert Vesco at the time of the elections, 1972 elections. And the evidence that came in later was conflict of jury to John Mitchell or Maurice Stans. And the prosecution puts on a weak case. If the prosecution doesn't come up with a strong case, then they're acquitted. And this happened with John Connally in Texas when he was involved in the milk scandal down there. And The prosecution just presents a little bit of evidence, the government being the prosecution. So John Connally is acquitted of crimes that are flagrant and can be documented over and over again. And Robert Vesco isn't brought home from Costa Rica. He has been involved in many illegal activities and involvement of the Security Exchange Commission involving hundreds, $230 million, some fund like that. And people are swindled out of large amounts of money coming into millions and billions, and they're not charged. Or this phony kidnapping of Reg Murphy, the publisher in Atlanta, Georgia. I always questioned that, and the man who kidnapped him wasn't even charged with kidnapping. He was charged with extortion, and that Mr. Williams at the time said it was linked to the SLA, and it had to do with Arab oil money and the right-wing extremists, and the gentleman was not charged with the stiffest penalties, and he'll get off. People like Mickey and Jack Scott were never charged for taking Patty Hearst from San Francisco or Berkeley to Pennsylvania, New York, and back to Pennsylvania, back to California. They weren't charged with that. And then we have trials like Nazi Germany holding still. Wendy Yoshimura hasn't been sentenced, and she'll get a slap on the hand and a leniency, even though she was paid a large amount of money to babysit with Patty Hearst, and she said keeping Patty wasn't living on the land was any different than being a sorority girl or going to college. And she makes pictures. She's an artist who sells to the Treasury Department. The building down Orange County has already bought one of her pictures, and there are a lot of people from very conservative parts of the community supporting Wendy Yoshimura, and she is not going to be sentenced. The judge just calls a halt to her sentencing, and the Harrises have not been charged with kidnapping Patty Hearst. Patty was kidnapped in 1974, and this is 1977, and Emily William Harris sit in some jail waiting. They haven't gone to trial yet for kidnapping Patty Hearst. The Chowchilla case will be called off. The defendants are sitting in jail, these three boys, and as time goes on, they're trying to discredit the bus driver, Mr. Ray, and use the story that the children are too young to testify against him. So if you sit long enough, you'll see people like William and Emily Harris get off from their charges, and Mickey and Jack Scott, and the Chowchilla case will fade away. There'll be some weak excuse, or their main witness, Mr. Ray, will drop dead, and they'll say the boys don't look like the men that were described in the first place, which is true. In that case, he'll get off. I got an article from the New York Post on the Ustashi terrorists. Those are a team of people that killed a policeman in New York City and then hijacked a plane to Chicago and then went up to Canada and to France. And they've asked the judge for leniency, and he's considering letting them off because of the word was he was tender-hearted or understanding, and that trial is hushed up because the Ustashi people who killed a cop are part of a worldwide plan of terror on the right, and the right wing is always getting off. These are high-level white-collar crimes. The same way with the murder of Mr. Letelier, the gentleman from Chile who was living in Washington, D.C., who was blown up with his secretary in the car. Anti-Castro Cubans were involved. The ammunition came from the Miami area. There was a trial in Venezuela, evidently, for a few of the men because they'll probably get off easier, be bought off down there. But the Cubans in the United States and the people that sold the gunpowder and those people involved in the Miami community are not being brought to trial and never will. You have a series of people who had false identification papers, one like James Earl Ray, who had three aliases and three passports, and he had a Social Security card given to him from the moment he left the Missouri prison, and he had these aliases until the day that he was used as a patsy to kill Martin Luther King. And I read that Sirhan is up for parole. He has a date about 8 years from now, which is a long time if you haven't killed anybody. But the alleged assassin will be on the streets, and I'm sure that he will settle for that rather than to speak about who he met with in terms of the conspiracy, if he can speak, if his hypnosis isn't so deep. So what I'm attempting to do many times in going back to this 45-minute news analysis each week, what I'm really trying to do is to open your eyes on a lot of cases, a lot of different levels, many levels of awareness, in hopes that maybe, just perchance, you will see parallels between what happened in Germany in 1922 to 1933 and then up through 1945. I don't have too many solutions to offer you about these parallels getting worse, but they are there, and I think the first problem in solving them is the level of awareness. So some weeks we talk about the SLA, some weeks we talk about the Howard Hughes hoax, and hope that the level of awareness of listeners will catch on that something is happening and that they are related in some way, and the relationships are what I also attempt to bring out from time to time. The areas of research that do occupy my mind, as I say, go beyond now the killings of John Kennedy or, say, Officer J.D. Tippit or Lee Harvey Oswald, the men that were killed in Dallas in 1963. They go into the perversion of justice and the lack of functioning of the courts and the use of the multinational corporations to continue to order these murders and to continue to control the Justice Departments. We get now Jimmy Carter, funded by the Coca-Cola, IBM, Lockheed, David Rockefeller Combine, and a graduate of Annapolis and Navy Intelligence to boot. And they continue the control. He's simply a puppet. And there's no way to prosecute any of the people that I've mentioned or really go further into the cases that I have been studying or reading lately, because they were linked to so much intelligence and counterintelligence and espionage that they can hide behind national security and not be prosecuted. It's like Richard Helms says, you can't prosecute me on the ITT matter and overthrowing Allende or having any part of that or for my perjury because of national security. Intertwined between the multinationals and CIA fronts is this cloak of national security. There's a memo allegedly from Howard Hughes, but written much after he was long out of the scene mentally, saying that he wanted connections with the CIA because then he couldn't be investigated, his operation, because of the connections with the CIA. That memo was supposed to have been written in the 60s, but Howard Hughes was used as a CIA front since its inception in 1947 when the National Security Council was formed and Hughes was a part of it. And in addition to these individual murders or the covers-up and the conspiracies, it's also my belief that these people are hell-bent on genocide, on weather control, on germ warfare, to reduce the population by millions and increase profits to the point of an economic depression, always holding out tight payments for your gasoline and transportation, your gas, your heat, your utilities, your rent, and your food. And then what's left after they're paid is going to be left for you. And that's all there is to it. The multinational corporations have seen domestically that they will get their share of the utilities that are necessary, the gas, heat, electricity, oil, transportation, rent, food, and medical profits also, your medical needs and drugs. And what's left you can have for the frills if you're lucky enough to have it left after it's through. Now, if and when the population at large were ever to catch on that this is happening, I don't really believe at this stage that they could do much about it. I don't mean to be so dismal today, and some days I'm not as dismal as others, but I do believe that the intelligence community has enough tranquilizers to put into the water system if we're not getting it already, or to put it into your food if we're not getting it already, to do what I think are chemical lobotomies. I don't put it past them. I believe that they're ruthless. I believe the same people that put Hitler into power and wanted genocide are putting chemicals into food and cutting off food supplies all over the country. And many, many people are going to die from cancer who aren't taking these newspapers 10 a day that I'm taking. In their own local areas, the meat, the poultry, the water is getting polluted with deadly chemicals. And we're sending these chemicals around the world to Japan and Pakistan and all over the world too, and it will change and eliminate a lot of the population. Alan Dulles, the head of the CIA, ordered 100 million LSD as early as 1965. It was a bargain in those days. It was $165,000 worth. But he doesn't explain or didn't explain why he wanted to drug one half the entire population of the United States of America. And I think when you get a peanut farmer like Jimmy Carter from the South, and the South is not being affected, Georgia, by the droughts that we're having. You have to ask yourself, why is he cutting off the money for dams in this state around the country that need it the most, in Utah, Nevada, California? How come, right in the midst of droughts, is he cutting off the building of dams? That would be like ordering snow for Buffalo a month ago. Why would he send in clouds to cause snow in Buffalo? Or why would he cut off dams, which we badly need? And I don't put it past the multinational to create any kind of profit they want. I saw an article from the Washington Post last week about sugar companies complaining that the sugar supply is not being sold enough, the sugar profits were down, that they would have to go into certain increases of sugar in diets or foods because the sugar profits weren't equal to what they were used to come out. And 7 days later to the day, there's an article that they're going to stop saccharin and sugar substitutes, and then we'll have to go back to the sugars or honey in our food. And yet we know that saccharin, by any test, by any imagination, there's no tests that are put out yet that equal what saccharin does to to our health as compared to cigarettes. We're told that cigarettes can cause cancer, they affect our lungs, they have a spin-off for other diseases, and Jimmy Carter and the administration didn't cut off selling cigarettes. They didn't stop the manufacture of cigarettes, even though they know that it definitely causes cancer, and there's no proof that the saccharin can cause cancer yet. It's so far removed, the doses that we'd have to take as compared to what they're giving animals. And yet, when Jimmy Carter won the election, he went immediately for his first meeting with the cabinet to the home of Mr. Reynolds, to an island in Georgia, where he goes to the Reynolds tobacco people and is entertained by them and goes back again a second time, and he meets with his cabinet. But the tobacco is all right, and I believe that the multinational corporations are greedy enough to cut off the products for people who don't want sugar in order to force people to take sugar back. They don't care about the health or the taste or the needs of people where you may want saccharin or diet drinks or diet ice cream and you don't want rich ice cream, and maybe the dairies aren't selling enough and the sugar people aren't selling enough, and so they make a ruling, or they're trying to pass it, about cutting off saccharin. And it's a game which followed immediately after a survey that the sugar profits were down and they needed more sugar. I feel that maybe I have a lot of beefs this week because I have a pile of about 600 articles, I think, that I brought in 10 or 15 to just briefly skim on the provision of the news lately, the turning away from facts and trials that are being curtailed, that aren't proceeding, and government scandals that aren't investigated, that are covered up. And it seems that everywhere there are liars in a high office. Another example of a liar in a high office is a warden up at Vacaville Prison by the name of Mr. Clonin. Just 2 weeks ago, there was a story in the news, and last week the Vacaville Prison was used for CIA experiments on the prisoners. Now, there's many people in the prisons who know this has been going on for a long time, and it came out in the Senator Church hearings last year that Vacaville had been used for experiments on the prisoners. And right away, there was a press release from Mr. Clonin, who's the warden up at Vacaville Prison in California, to the effect that if the CIA was doing experimentations, it was done surreptitiously, or he wasn't aware that it was happening, and that it must have come from people from the outside who were visiting inside the prison. Well, that part is true. We had Colston Westbrook, with his links to Stanford Research, who was visiting Donald DeFries at Vacaville Prison, and telling him and programming him and hypnotizing him that he would become this great leader, that he would take the place of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. We did have outsiders. The most gross was Colston Westbrook and a group of other white people visiting with Donald DeFries and twisting his brain that he would be this black leader, and that did happen at Vacaville. But I don't believe that the warden there, Mr. Clonin, didn't know it all along, because he doesn't have his prisoners photographed with black names and black power fists meeting with these white people at the special black studies with such conversations going on. But he had this press release that CIA wasn't involved, and those of you that know Dialogue Conspiracy know that that is an outright lie. I did many shows on Robert Hyde, who was sent up to Vacaville for psychosurgery to have his brain removed. And I got Robert High's name from the attorney for Sirhan Sirhan down in Los Angeles, Robert Hansen. And I can document this. And Jack Kimbrough, the researcher, gave me a letter sent by Robert Hyde to Sirhan's attorney. And Hyde, his family has been in military intelligence all of his life, and his brother is now working at Port Authority in New York City, who is the Pentagon in intelligence. And Robert knew too much about the John Kennedy assassination, the Robert Kennedy assassination. Evel Younger's name was attached to the Hyde file as saying keep him in prison. And they had the nerve to come to Hyde and tell him that they were removing his brains and his memory because of what he knew about the assassinations. And they even told his wife, and the wife called an attorney and said, there's nothing you can do to interfere with the prison system. And I just bring this up again on Dialogue Conspiracy because Clonin says he doesn't know that the CIA works at Vacaville. And these are known liars in public position of power, and they shouldn't have that kind of power, and they're never fired for telling a lie, and the beat goes on. And in the next weeks, I'm going to go, as I say, into the matters of courts and the matters of murders, and we won't do background again. We'll just run through a lot of recent murders and the kind of conspiracies I'm talking about. One, for example, I have mentioned on Dialogue Conspiracy is Emile Dehori, the art forger, who worked with Clifford Irving, wrote the books about Howard Hughes. He wrote a book, Clifford Irving, called Hoax, about Dehori, and then Clifford Irving wrote this book about Howard Hughes that turned out not to be based on actual interviews with Howard Hughes. Well, Dehori had an interview in the New York Times, and this was February 18th, 1972. And he was talking, the United Press International reported that Emile Dehori, the art forger, who was the subject of one of Mr. Irving's books, walked into its offices in Madrid yesterday to look at the reports of Mr. Hughes' departure. That's another hoax, he said. Hughes died a long while ago. I know it. Well, at the time that the Mormon will was to be decided upon in Las Vegas, Nevada, and I just a month ago, and I said 2 months ago rather, and I said that Dehori is the only man who could have written this will so closely that it resembled Howard Hughes to even go to court. The same day that this was to go to court, Dehori died in Spain. No autopsy, no message for his family, just dead. And Dehori knew that Howard Hughes was dead, just like I wrote in 1974 that Hughes had been dead since 1971. And this was in the New York Times, 1972. He had gone to the UPI and said the whole Hughes thing is a hoax. He's been dead since 1972. Well, Dehori conveniently dies in 1976 at the time they're trying to find out who wrote this will. Two other people died as a basis of books that came out this year. One was, 1975 rather, Eli Black. A book came out called An American Company, written by Thomas McCann. It was a book about United Brands and the fact that the United Fruit Company, the largest producer of bananas, a division of United Brands, was involved with the CIA. When this book came out, Eli Black fell out of the 44th floor of the Pan American building, and it was a book at the heat of Watergate in 1975, talking about the CIA using United Brands and the part that Eli Black had. Now, I guess I'm bitter. I resent people like Leon Jaworski traveling around with a best-selling book on Watergate or John Dean's book on the bestseller list every month on Watergate when they can travel and tour and talk about their books, but you haven't heard about the book Thomas McCann, An American Company. It was published in 75. I haven't seen it. It isn't on the market. It wasn't sold. Was it bought up? Was it taken off the market? Was it stopped when the hearings were taking place because the defendants of Watergate were involved down in Central America with this company? Eli Black, the head of United Brands, goes flying out of the 44th floor of the Pan American building in New York City. The book isn't published and there's no lecture tours. And then a book came out just this last December, John M. Blair. And he's not traveling around with his book. It's called The Control of Oil. And he died of a sudden heart attack 10 days before his book went to press. You ought to buy it and get a hold of this book. I'm going to. And it exposes the Seven Sisters, the oil companies, how they control your oil, how they determine the price of your oil, how they have a monopoly on your oil. He's criticized the corporations. He's fought with the Federal Trade Communications. He tried to expose the truth, and he's not alive to promote his book. So people like Eli Black aren't around to take the stand, and John Blair isn't around to promote his book, and the liars are getting the promotions. There was even a cartoon in the paper last Sunday of college students, and there was a brochure there on the wall of people coming to lecture, like E. Howard Hunt and John Dean and Jeb Magruder, E.J. Pearl, a whole list of Watergate defendants, and then below it was suggesting Richard Nixon. And one student is saying to the other one, we should take a course in lying. Well, I have a list. As I say, next week we're going to go down an article on the $10 million fiasco the United States taxpayers paid General Dynamics for a mistake they made. Here's another article last month on General Dynamics gets a $730 million loan from the United States, and it has to do with a $3 million extra commission they gave to a South Korean businessman involving oil tankers and Mr. Park of South Korea. I want to talk about Mr. Crown, Henry Crown, who owns $1,600,000 in shares, 1,600,000 shares in General Dynamics, who's so rich, he's one of the wealthiest men in the world. He owns 1 million shares in the Hilton Hotels, 400,000 shares in Aetna Life. His holdings add up to the billions, a billion at least, and he is a major stockholder in General Dynamics. Well, we pay them out $10 million on something they didn't deliver. The stockholders are still raking in the millions, and while we loan them $730 million, they can go broke. They have holdings in many, many other countries, and the taxpayer is stuck with the loan instead of giving it to small businesses. There's a case here of a man who stole for the FBI. This was in the Washington, New York Times, rather. It wasn't in the Washington Post. He kept doing burglaries for the FBI, and he'd steal papers for them and turn them over. Mr. Redfern, he took from the Socialist Workers Party. But while he was doing the burglaries, he'd also take items from the house and clean out offices for his own personal use while he was employed by the FBI in order to make it look like a legitimate burglary. Only he kept the furniture and the equipment, which came to thousands of dollars, turned the papers over to the FBI, but that confused the motive, you see, the burglary, and he got to keep the goodies. The son of a Protestant minister with a degree in philosophy from Colorado State College, who interspersed burglarizing with doing seven other burglaries in Denver, and he thought he was immune because he was taking for the FBI, and then they couldn't finger him. He wasn't prosecuted on any of these cases after the judge said allowed him to say that he'd no longer associate with known criminals. I pulled this article out to share with you because the only known criminals he was with were with the FBI, and the judge says, we won't prosecute with you. We'll let it go. There's another case of a $23 million fraud. The United States is suing grain firms. They overweighted, they misgraded, they added other materials to the wheat. The taxpayers left with it. These large corporations are involved. A 52-count complaint, and the only thing that happens after all this cheating is that certain people resign and they're never punished. The grain went to South Vietnam, India, Pakistan, Chile, Turkey, and Greece. As I say, there's a 52-count complaint, $223.1 million in damages and penalties. They'll get a slap on a wrist. They were charged. This was in December. They never go to court. They'll never be charged. Another article about Watergate probers joining the law firm. This is what reminds me of Nazi Germany. Former U.S. Attorney Henry Peterson, who was supposed to prosecute the Watergate case and bungled it completely, joined the law office of William Hunley, who was John Mitchell's attorney, in exchange for not fingering conspirator John Mitchell. And that's all it is, because John Mitchell was guilty and he got off from the prosecution, at least until James McCord started talking. And Mitchell still isn't in jail. Peterson goes on and then works for John Mitchell's attorney. Another great investigator was Seymour Glanzer from the Justice Department, who failed dismally in the Watergate investigations. He left the Justice Department and now works with the law firm of Dick Stein, Shapiro, and Morin, the company that defended Spiro T. Agnew, and Charles Colson. Colson is the big hero who wrote a book, is doing a movie. He'll make $1 million off the movie. Agnew travels all around the world representing multinational corporations in the Middle East, Iran, and Saudi Arabia so that they become millionaires. They don't have to be in Washington, D.C. The law office that let Spiro Agnew off the hook with weak prosecutions has appointed one of the prosecutors, Seymour Glanzer, and the other prosecutor, the third one of Watergate, was Earl Silbert, and then he was appointed U.S. attorney for the District District of Columbia. He became the head U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia. These are the kind of rewards that take place. Another great figure in Watergate and in the Nixon administration was Roy Ash from Litton Industry. He started his career taking $43 million off the book of used aircraft out in California to form Litton Industry through overcharges and never went to court. And so history catches up with Mr. Roy Ash. And by December of this year, Litton Industry is involved with an article. This is a large article from the Los Angeles Times. Says Litton and the Navy are playing chicken with their ships. Hundreds of millions of dollars are at stake. Litton Industry has closed down their ships as of August the 1st, this last August, of the Navy, and let off 2,700 people. They're asking more than $100 million just temporarily in cash for their overcharges, and they've gone into $1 billion overcharge for four ships. The Navy blames it on the Beverly Hills-based conglomerate. They're overcharged a total of $1 billion. The ships would be reduced. Five ships would be $947 million each. Now, they say if we don't have the extra billions of dollars for overcharge, not including the cost of the ships, we will stop building the ships altogether, which means the taxpayers are out millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars are here. So what else is new? When Roy Ash became head of the Office of Management Budget for Richard Nixon, people should have looked into his background when he took the $43 million from Hughes in Santa Monica. He couldn't manage his own books, and he couldn't manage the taxpayers' money. And then he becomes a contractor, which is, I think, is a conflict of interest with Office of Management Budget anyway, and fouls up the shipyards and asks $1 billion. Well, the $1 billion overcharge could be siphoned to more espionage and more spying and more funding. Roy Ash was the secret conduit of funds to overthrow Greece. Litton Industry was used by the CIA to overthrow Greece. So that if the taxpayers give him $1 billion overcharge for a ship, we don't know if the money goes to a ship. It could go to spies all over the world, and the beat goes on. Sometimes I get overwhelmed at the amount of deaths, the amount of court cover-ups. I like to talk about single cases at length, such as Robert Hyde sometimes, or the Chowchilla case. And sometimes I just look at the pile of articles I'd like to share with you, and I wish that there was a marathon of 10 or 20 hours where I could throw all the deaths at you, all the court cases, so you could see that the courts aren't working. Finally, there's one in Hollywood. A doctor supplied, Dr. Don Carlos Macho supplied drugs to the little girl Buffy, who was in The Family Affair, who died. And he had long lines of people, adolescents, standing in front of his office waiting for prescriptions, and he would hand out these drugs to these people. Evidently, the authorities knew that he was doing it. So when they didn't arrest him, but when the police came to see him, they cleared him of all charges. But what he says, what the attorney said, was he was senile, and it was only a matter of time before you'd come by and tell me to stop. This is what he said. It was only a matter of time before you told me to stop. He wasn't charged with the death of this woman. He wasn't charged with prescribing these drugs or told what they were. They were a horrendous combination of drugs. He just said, I knew you'd come by. And then he was acquitted of all charges, and they released him, and he can go on dispensing drugs. Sorry I sound so gloomy today. This is Mae Brussel, Dialogue Conspiracy in Carmel, California. Maybe I'll feel better next week. I hope so, but the news is really bad.
This has been Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for many years has been researching the facts behind political assassinations and conspiracies in this country. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KLRB-FM in Carmel, California.